You know, you know that, and it's absolutely true that, you know, so many years have passed since the historical war. And I would say, and would like very much to remark, that nobody really expected. I believe that very, very few people, if you would approach them during this day of June, and I myself was an officer on one of the fronts, and talking with people and having many friends who participated in the war, nobody really predicted that this would be the result. I would say even on formal level, as the war ended, there were some informal talks, in fact, advanced by a number of military people and people from the security forces from Mossad, David Kimchi and Shlomo Gazit, in order to find a solution and maybe possibly even establish some kind of autonomy in the area. So this is one very interesting indication. And another one was that at that time, when already sometime later appeared the first ideas of possible settlement. I don't know how many of you know, but the settlement really began in 1968. If I remember well, it was in Hebron, in a hotel park, where Jews arrived in order to reestablish the Jewish settlement in Hebron. So it ended, so many of you may not know, in 1929, when there was a massacre of Jews in Hebron by Arabs again in 1929, and this was the end of a century, really, of Jewish living in the city. So the legal counsel of the foreign ministry, a guy by name Todor Meron, who eventually became one of the very, very worldwide legal expert, and I think that he lives now in Canada, was asked an opinion at that time, what is the legal view about possibly establishing Jewish settlements in the just conquered West Bank or Gaza Strip. And he wrote an opinion, legal opinion, that it will be contrary to the Geneva Convention and should not be done. And this document, which is interestingly was hidden, and only in the last years it was found, and you can find it in Google. Anyone that will Google will find it in Internet, this document. So the beginning was, in certain way, I would say even optimistic, but very, very soon it was established a movement which became almost a mainstream movement, which was called the whole Eretz Israel, Eretz Israel, Tnuat Eretz Israel. And the idea was that here we have a kind of a redemption miracle that brings an unbelievable opportunity to return back to the size of the kingdom and redemption of Israel, and this opportunity should be held. And people from the mainstream of the Jewish society, which included the leading writers, even Shai Agnon, the first Israeli Nobel Prize, and the generals like Avraham Yaffe, Nathan Alterman, which means people who were coming from the Labor Party at that time, Mapai, even not talking, obviously, people that were coming, what later became a Likud, were united. And I think it was September, 67 of them had a declaration that really this is an opportunity. The land is not occupied. It is liberated. We should stay forever as part of Israel. Interestingly, as a fact, historical fact, that just on the same day, in another coffee house in Tel Aviv, very few people, about, I think, 16, 17, people that were relatively marginal but also came from the intellectual circles, had absolutely opposite declaration that was issued, and they said that we must retreat as quickly as possible, withdraw from the area, because keeping the conquest, keeping the occupation, eventually will cause to a disaster to the Israeli society and to the state of Israel. So here we are in 2013, after these two declarations, and I think that at the moment, many, many, many Israelis, and not really marginal, but coming from the mainstream, feel exactly what this very, very small minority of people thought in September 1967, thought it will bring to a disaster, change the nature of the country. And I would say even to add to you is the number of people who signed originally, like Chaim Guri and other who signed this first declaration about Eretz Yisrael HaShlema, at the moment they regret and feel that it was a terrible, terrible, major, major mistake, and Israel is paying a terrible price. And looking back this perspective, really, many of us in academia and in other really layers of the society know this. You know, you can see, I hope you will be able to see the very, very seminal film documentary that came out, also almost got the Oscar this year. It was nominated. There were two Israeli films that were nominated, and in fact, through these two films, you could see the disaster that I was talking. One of the films, which is called Shomrei Asaf, which means the gatekeepers, in which six heads of Shabak are interviewed. Shabak will be the equivalent to FBI, people that are responsible for the security, as we are calling them, the gods, walking gods in Israel, because those are the ways that Israelis view generals and heads of Shabak or Mossad, and all of them have a very, very critical view of the situation, critical view of the process, critical view of the occupation, and so we're not talking about marginal people, ostracized people, and people like this are, but people who are coming from the heart of the security establishment, who realize with great difficulty, obviously, devoting their career to the security, that the occupation is in many respects a cancer to the Israeli society, should end as quickly as possible. And I would like, maybe before questions will be pouring, to say that exactly 2 days ago, we heard two in Israel and probably you in the United States, the speech of John Kerry, who is really almost with great effort and tireless trying to bring here some kind of sanity, a kind of sober really consideration in order to change the course of history. And he declared that we have a very unique opportunity, that maybe very little time is left in order to reverse the deterioration, possible deterioration. So it's extremely important when I talk with Jews in the United States, because I deeply believe that you should not be bystanders watching, standing, and some of the American Jews even support the course of the policies that was led by the Israeli government, but you have an important role in convincing the American establishment as well as Israeli establishment that we need to prevent the deterioration that is so already in the site.
Thank you very much, Professor Bertal. I would like to, this is Ori Meir in Washington with Americans for Peace Now. I'd like to remind people that if they'd like to ask a question, to encourage them to dial 5-star. You dial 5-star, that indicates to me that you would like to ask a question, and I will call on you. The question that I would like to ask you before we take questions from our participants, Professor Bertal, is if you could just say a few words about the nature of the book that you've edited with Professor Schnell, and particularly the conclusions that the two of you have drawn from the articles that you have commissioned for the book about the type of long-lasting impact that such a long-lasting occupation has on Israeli society. Maybe I'll tell you a quick story. During the first Intifada, when I was covering Palestinian affairs, I remember having a conversation with an Israeli general at the time. It was a private living room conversation. And I remember being stunned by something that this general said, which was that actually the friction between young Israeli soldiers, men and women, and the civilian population is a good experience. It's something that makes them stronger, makes them tougher, helps them to deal with difficult situations, make good judgment and things of that sort. And I'd like to ask you if in general, you know, kind of magnifying, zooming out and looking at Israeli society in a more general way, has the impact been positive, something that has kind of honed Israelis, or different in your opinion?
Well, you know, it's really a large scale question, but I can really respond to the anecdote or stories that you are telling with a much better really illuminations of the answers that you received. You know, I am surprised, and maybe I am not surprised. You know, I try to be balanced what the officer told you. You know, on the one hand, what did you want to hear? You know, he has to rationalize in many respects the acts, you know, his orders, his position, his policy, etc. But I can tell you, which is not a secret at the moment, that exactly at time I was serving at the command in the army, which is responsible for psychology and sociology, which means it was a scientific unit. And with me were many different professors of psychology, sociology, some of them even political science. And two of them, in fact, were asked exactly during the first Intifada to research the effects of the Intifada on the Israeli soldiers. And the results were absolutely very, very sad, that it has an effect on Israeli soldiers, very negative effect, that soldiers are carrying acts that very often are against their moral values. They are forced to do it by the orders. They are doing it sometimes willingly even, but as a result, they leave the scene with scars, psychological scars, and I'm sure that you are not surprised because there is a lot of research in American Army with regard to Vietnam or even with Iraq, and those are findings that are universal, that the Army is not sent to put down a mutiny, because Intifada is a mutiny. Intifada is a term which is interestingly used because it covers really a very unpleasant experience, because Intifada doesn't have any meaning in English and in Hebrew, but in principle Intifada is really uprising, pricing of people who really strive to get their independence, who would like to get their self-determination. It's a pricing as it happened in the past in different countries, including in United States, where there was a pricing. You called it a revolution in 1774. So this was very similar, and any army that tries to put down a uprising, mutiny, by definition, has to resort to brutality. And in First Intifada, I will tell you that for some of you may be news, but our beloved Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, who was at that time Minister of Defense, ordered what is well known to break their hands and legs. And it sounds terrible, but it was done. And even there were a number of trials of soldiers who caught or arrested civilians, and in order to prevent from participation in the mutiny in Intifada, their hands and legs were broken. So can you imagine a young soldier, 19, who served in the army and is ordered to break the legs and hands of a Palestinian civilian? Let's say that he even did something wrong. For example, he threw stones. And we have to remember that during the First Intifada, there was a relatively very little use of firearms. Mostly it was a war of stones. And so you can imagine what does it mean when he goes home with doing this type of act. So with the results of the study were, so people carry a very, very serious negative scars when they go home. The army did not like this, the study, and the study was, as you could imagine, immediately put in cabinet. And these guys, two very known professors, so if you can interview them, they still are alive. In fact, one of them, I'm sorry, is alive, one died. One is Professor Charles Greenbaum at Hebrew University. The other one was Professor Dan Baron of Ben-Gurion University. He already died. And both of them were fired from the army, and they published, really decided to publish the study, and for some time people could get the study. So here you have a very specific outcome of occupation, absolutely in contrast to what you heard from the officer, but this is only one aspect. The book is covering many different aspects. We assembled a very prominent group of social scientists and humanities, people that are expert in democracy, people that are expert in legal system, people that are experts in army, and each of them picked up different aspects and wrote a very comprehensive chapter covering the particular aspect. And it is something that you, anyone that follows the Israeli news knows and will not be surprised when we'll hear that occupation is one of the reasons that led to corruption and to serious deterioration of democracy in Israel. Take just one example, you know, that will be. You have to know, everyone has to know, that settlements, Jewish settlement, cannot take place without either formal or informal approval of the government and the army. So if they take place and you find today, which is absolutely known and salient, that some of the settlements were built on private land of Palestinians which means that it was done against the law, against the Israeli law. You don't take a land of a private person and build a settlement. It cannot be done. But the Israeli government did it, and the army did it. Settlers performed it, but it was done with approval. So here you have an example how occupation corrupted the government, corrupted the legal system, and led to a situation when many of the outposts and many of the Jewish settlements are built on private land. And just recently, we witnessed a decision by the Supreme Court which ordered the government to destroy or to remove the Jewish settlement from the private land of the Palestinians.
Thank you, Professor Bartal. Again, remind people that in order to ask a question, they should punch 5-star. Our first question comes from Nancy Bernstein. Please go ahead, Nancy.
Okay, thank you. I have a question about the impact. I haven't read your book, but the impact of the occupation on Israelis who are not, currently serving in the army, the impact of sort of maybe possibly being in denial about the impact of the occupation on Palestinians and things like that, like, you know, sort of repressing things in a way and how that might impact society in general, day-to-day things, even relationships between people, you know, couples and parents and children and things like that.
Okay, this is exactly why a topic that I did the research. There is an article that it was published in Hebrew, even in Megamot, which is a major Israeli social science journal, as well in Journal of Peace Research. And you are right. You know, a society, any society, which is not really unique to Israelis, that members of the society perform acts which are negating values. So occupation by its nature cannot be enlightened as it was presented in the Israeli society. It is brutal by its nature because the occupied society is resisting. So whenever it's resisting, is using either non-violent or violent means in order to resist education, to resist occupation, and the occupying society, by its nature, tries to control, to supervise, to put in order. And here we have a major, major conflict of interest. One wants to end occupation, and another one wants to continue the occupation. So the acts, again, by the nature, are violent. And, you know, anyone that will open any kind of reports that is going on either from different NGO books, reports in press, will find what is going on in occupied territories. In some periods, it obviously wars. In some period is more calm. But if you will take the number that until today, about 750,000 Palestinians were arrested. We're talking about 4.5 million people. And people were in courts, people were tortured, and who is doing all of this? Israeli soldiers, young soldiers, and they have to cope. It obviously runs against value of any human person. So how do you deal with this? Because usually you don't hurt a neighbor that you hate, a neighbor that may be very nasty, and you don't come and just slap on his face, but you know that he's human being and there are certain norms, and you control yourself in spite of the fact that you hate him. So here you are in the occupied area, and you are doing many, many different transgressions is advanced, very basic values of how you should treat human beings. So what are the solutions? Solutions are exactly in the direction that you indicated. For example, we found in studies in Israel that soldiers in checkpoints that are very active in humiliating Palestinians are the one that also dehumanize them the most. So what is not allowed to do to human beings, you can maltreat and carry towards people may call primitive, people that you call terrorists or other terms. And again, I want which is point out which is then so it's again and not a Jewish Israeli invention. It goes everywhere in the world. As an expert on intergroup serious, what I call intractable conflicts everywhere, Rwanda, Sri Lanka, wherever you will go, you find system, which means a psychological coping with unpleasant situation. And when you carry this type of coping, you may even perform terrible atrocities. And if we just will go to Rwanda, you have to remember that the Tutsi, who were murdered, about 800,000 of them, also Hutu, in the most horrible way, they are dehumanized and considered as cockroaches. So obviously human beings, it's very difficult to kill, but cockroaches is very easy to kill, and therefore you can do it even in a very personal way, the way that it was done in Rwanda with machetes and not from a distance when you shoot, which is even easier than approaching a person. So it's the same type of mechanism are here in the occupied territory, and it's not an accident that you find in the present time what we call, and open any Israeli paper, what we call the struggle against racism, which is spreading out. And this is, again, one of the consequences, in my opinion, of the ongoing occupation, which leads to downgrading Palestinians as being occupied society, because it has to be maltreated by the very nature of occupation.
Yeah, this is Gregory Lowe.
Yes, Gregory, please go ahead and ask your question.
Yes, Professor, I think that probably the majority of the people who are on the phone too with you will agree with your analysis of the effect of the occupation. But I think that there probably is another part of the Israeli population that would justify the occupation just out of fear that of terrorism and some of the negative things that happen. And I don't know how you change their minds and reverse this whole situation, which is obviously very bad. So I would like you to comment. I think that it's a two-sided problem, and that's one of the reasons it's not being solved.
Yeah, you are absolutely right. I mean, there's no doubt about. First, you know, I really do not want, and it will be contrary to my belief that there is no threat. There is threat. We do live in a context which is threatening, but partially of the context is a result of occupation, which leads to some kind of vicious cycle. So as I just analyzed before, occupation by definition, everywhere in the world, when the occupied society resists occupation, leads to threat. And in addition, there are obviously other sources of threat, beginning with Iran, Hezbollah, Hamas. We are living, But again, I want to repeat it very clearly, that part of it is really fueled by the occupation. Yes, Israelis live in fear. The fear is very, very high. And as I noted, partially it is as Israelis read the situation. But I would like to add to this that fear is also learned. Fear is also acquired. So it's not only based of real reading of the situation, but it is very based on these two factors, and one is the ways that Israelis view their collective memory, and second, the ways that the leaders talk with Israelis. And if you follow really our leaders, you will find that threat is one of the very frequent use emotion in the Israeli public discourse. We are almost laughing that every day there is a new threat. At the moment is Syria, next day will be Hezbollah, and then again Syria, and then Egypt, etc., etc. Then we have the Arab Spring, and this is really part of the public discourse. And and I do believe that the fear maintains very much hawkish beliefs. And your question is how it is possible to reduce it. Very, very difficult. You are right. This context is detrimental to any peace process, which goes together with lack of trust, we have to add. So we don't have only fear, but there is a lack of trust, which is also very much perpetuated by leaders, and which is also very interesting because in Israel, especially in the present period, if you read the Israeli press, especially with economic and social issues, you will find that leaders are not trusted. But when it comes to security leaders, and especially to military leaders, they are very, very trusted on these issues and very supported by Israeli public opinion. So it is very difficult to change this course, how to reduce, but the discourse that is led in the Israeli public is not God-given. If you will, again, go back to the 90s, early 90s, and will read the public discourse that was led by Yitzhak Rabin, it was very different. During the 94, 95, at the times that there was a terror, and he had the very known sentence which said that we will be pursuing peace as if terror does not exist, and we will be fighting terror as if peace does not exist, that which means that the goal is to achieve a really peace at the same time to fight terror with all the strength, but the present government is perpetuating the ideas of not maybe all, but at least some of the ministers. You hear with them that Palestinians cannot be trusted, peace cannot be achieved, and perpetuate all kind of scenario that provide a very fearful future. And Israelis, who obviously have a collective memory that goes not only to diaspora anti-Semitism, especially with Shoah, which is another very misused and used, as you want, a memory in Israel, very often noted and compared to the present situation. Netanyahu does it often with different situation. And when fear is used, I must admit that sometimes I feel in certain way even helplessness, because fear is very basic emotion, very powerful. It overflows any rationality. We know as psychologists it's strength. But this is really probably one of the problems, the ways of public discourse is carried here, and it depends very much on leaders to what direction they want to lead the nation. So my hope is, Ronnie, that once the peace process will begin, if the leaders will decide to lead us in this direction, also the arousal of fear will be reduced, and the public will be able to develop hope, which is very conducive to the peacemaking process.
Thank you. Before we take our next question, I just wanted to make sure that I understood something that you said, which I think is a very interesting, very important insight, which is that one of the impacts of this prolonged, intractable occupation is the reinforcement of negative emotions, negative attitudes in the Israeli public, such as racism and hatred and the dehumanization of the Palestinians, because it serves a certain psychological need for Israelis. In other words, they have to somehow rationalize their this abnormal situation that they're in of occupying another people, and they do that through the dehumanization of the Palestinians. Is that a right depiction of what
absolutely,
you
absolutely. And what you find, you it's again one of the lines of research that I carried, and I will tell you really very sad news that these images are acquired as at very early age. We carried in the 90s, so even in times that still the peace process was considered as going on, and we carried very large-scale studies with very young children, 3 years old. Listen, 3 years old, 4 years old. And we even, children that still don't have a clear concept of an Arab, found in some of the studies that the word Arab, without understanding fully the meaning of the concept, erases immediately very negative reaction. I would say almost that it is in the air. It's part of the climate. But now, you know, in 9/13, again, you know, I am not telling you a secret. I don't know how many of you follow the Israeli discourse, the Israeli press, the Israeli events. Rashism became one of the major problems to the extent that the government in its platform, because of the pressure coming from Yesh Atid and Tnua, decided that one of the issues that the government will tackle will be racism, which is spread, and almost every day we have news that are absolutely outraging. You know, take just three events that took place in last week. You know, one, the discoveries of the park had a policy of separating Arab children and Jewish children, not bringing them together. Amusement park. Another news that came out was about a very sad story where a father murdered two daughters, and as a woman, Palestinian, came to a police complaining that the father may do it, and the officers were laughing at her, saying that she is a Palestinian Arab, not taking seriously her complaint. She was coming back time after time, and she was ignored, and eventually the two girls were murdered.
And this is a Palestinian citizen of the State of Israel.
Right. And it caused a lot of, you know, take the remark of the mayor of Nazareth, Upper Nazareth, who is a Jewish, because we have two cities, Nazareth and Upper Nazareth. Nazareth is Arab city, and Upper Nazareth is a Jewish city. And the mayor that is up to election sent to every home to be, because he wants to be reelected, and he wrote a letter saying that they have to reelect him because he knows how to deal with Arabs, and he is using all kind of methods that he cannot reveal in order to prevent Arabs from buying apartments in Nazareth. Can you imagine that this will happen in New Jersey, for example, that a mayor will say that I know all kind of methods and I'm using the Jews will not buy apartments in New Jersey City, right?
Sure.
So it's those are really outraging events, and they steer, I must say, public debates. But what you will notice that the leading leaders, including Netanyahu or the previous Minister of Education, did not react, did not say anything, which will be obviously unheard. Can you imagine that such events will take place in the United States vis-a-vis Afro-American or Hispanic, and governor will not say something or the president will not say something, you know, but we are in a very different atmosphere, and because of these new norms, we are facing really institutionalized racism, yes.
Good. I'd like to accommodate a couple more participants that we have who would like to ask a question. We'll try to end this conversation on the hour. The next question comes from Everett. Please go ahead.
Hi, Professor. Given what you've just said, in your opinion, do you believe that modern Israelis possess the will to both endure and accept the increased short-term threat that would almost certainly come with withdrawal in the interest of a longer-term peace?
I'm not sure that I really heard. Can you say whether average Israeli will accept the withdrawal from the occupied territories in because of the long-term threat to the nature of the state?
Well, no. Actually, the opposite. I'm asking, do you believe that that the will exists to accept the short-term threat that would almost certainly come with a withdrawal from the West Bank in the interest of a longer-term peace?
I am still not clear. Who has to accept the withdrawal? Are you asking about Israelis or the world?
I'm asking if you believe the Israeli population has the will to endure the threat that will come with a withdrawal.
I see. Okay. I'm sorry. Now I am clear.
The premise, if I may just Everett's premise is that there will be a security threat to Israelis
right.
in the short term if there's a withdrawal from the West Bank. Will they be willing to accept that
right,
kind of short-term
right.
threat for the
yes,
benefit of the long-term benefit?
Yes,
yeah.
Okay, first, you know, I would like to make two comments. One is that peace by its nature is a process of risk-taking, right? I also feel,
right.
you know, nobody is that there will be a complete, you know, utopian peace, you know, idyllic peace, you know, and it should not be even sold and presented in this way. Making peace is, to some extent, risk-taking. But the present situation is also a situation of risk-taking. You know, we are, many of us expect that eventually there will be a third uprising, what is called Intifada. You know, nations, that resist occupation from time to time raise and fight for their self-determination. And it cannot last for a long period. So you have another type of threat. There is a threat of isolation of Israel, which is also a threat. So you always have to wait what are the risks and what are the opportunities. But it is clear that continuation of the situation is riskier than really making peace. And then for the long term, many Israelis realize, and this is probably one of the major reasons, the two very known hawks changed their opinion. Our previous Prime Minister, Ehud Olmert, who was, you know, if you look what were his opinions in the 80s, and Tzipi Livni, the present Minister of Justice, they were a very well-established hawks. And change the opinion. They change the opinion not because of moral consideration. You have to know that very, very few people really take into account more consideration. Most of the people approach and their views because of utilitarian consideration. And the consideration is that Israel, as President Obama said and Kerry said, that we are standing before a dilemma that either earlier or later we will have to face. Israeli state will not be able to continue in the term of 20 years, 30 years, which means it will touch on our children and grandchildren, continue to be democratic and as it is now, and continue the occupation, and we'll have to decide between apartheid or between democracy, or being Jewish state and democratic or apartheid. And this is really very frightening choice. It's true that Israelis are escaping. You can come to Tel Aviv and you would not believe what is going on. People are enjoying life. Very few people are considering what is going on 20 kilometers or 30 miles from Tel Aviv. Tel Aviv is filled up in coffee houses. Many, many cultural events are going on. A very good life, and they don't. But I do believe that if the leaders will decide and will lead, Israelis will accept the judgment. So they will take the risk, because the risks are discussed. They are in the public discourse. They are not salient, because nobody is interested at the moment. I exaggerate, but most of the Israelis, the mainstream of Israelis, is not interested and not preoccupied with the problem of occupation, because there are no problems. You know, look just what is going on. So I described it. Life is very good. You know, in a few days there will be celebration for our president. You know, hundreds of people, leaders are coming. So Israelis feel that at the moment is everything is okay and fine. Life can continue. We can celebrate. Clearly, if the leaders will explain the situation, and my equation is very simple. People have to realize that the cost of solving the problem at the moment are lower than the costs that will be in the future if the occupation will continue. This is the equation. And we have a lot of information and layers that to indicate exactly that this is the equation. So I believe that the very determined leaders will lead us in this direction. The problem is that Netanyahu is not at this point, as I believe, and he is not yet convinced that it's necessary to compromise and lead the nation really with determination towards peacemaking.
Thank you. We have time for a short question and a short answer. Our next question, last question, comes from a female voice whose name, unfortunately, I didn't get, and I apologize. Please go ahead.
Carol Price.
Thank you.
I think. Am I?
Yes, that's you.
A short question. I was just wondering about the effect on the conduct of the military. I'm assuming that the effects of the attitudes we've been talking about and the effects of the occupation over time cause internal conflict with young men entering, young women and men entering the Army, and also maybe conflicts between soldiers and internal conflict, and how that affects the cohesiveness of the military. And that's the question.
Okay, so you know, it's a very complex question, because there is no really simple answer. First, you have to realize that in Israel, army is a superstar in a very high status. The officer is probably the most valuable role. High officer, as I noted before, is a walking god. Army is has the highest trust as an Israeli institution. I think it reaches about 85%, which is the highest. And I could go now for hours and hours to explain to you why does it happen. But one reason is that it's a nation army. You know, we all have children, cousins, fathers, brothers, sisters, or, you know, in the army. Criticize the army, to look negatively at the army is really looking at us negatively, and nobody looks at himself, herself negatively. No, nobody likes to look in the mirror. So this is part of the answer, really. But the army also has a policy, which is a very interesting policy, that people who do not want to serve in the army, except when it comes as a sector, because at the moment there is a very big debate what to do with Haredim, with the ultra-Orthodox society, and just now Israel is in the process to force them to serve in the army. But when as individual, even because of conscience, you don't want to serve in the army, army is very happy not to take you to the army on the one condition, that you don't say it openly. So you say, I don't want to serve the army because of psychological reasons, and the army is immediately taking you out. One of the very known cases that just ended 2 days ago is a guy by Nathan Blank who was determined to fight the army on the basis of conscience, saying that he is pacifist and he doesn't want to serve in the army. The army put him into prison because they didn't want to accept the reason, because the army does not accept the fact that someone may refuse because of conscience. The guy sat in prison 195 days. Eventually, there was a public pressure, and just as I said, 2 days ago, he was released from the army, and the army did not succeed to break him. So there are effects. Nobody talks about them. They are hidden. On the surface, things are, with respect to the army, fine. But we know, I know, many people who deal with stress know that soldiers leave the army often with traumatic experience. Take the fact, you know, just one fact at the end, that developed a norm in Israel that soldiers, especially middle upper class, that usually have more humanistic moral values, leave Israel after serving in the army. What they call is to clean their head. So you can understand any way that you want this expression. But the fact is that today, at this moment, about 40,000 Israeli youngsters are moving between South America, Asia, and mostly those are the places, New Zealand, immediately with the end of the service for a year or two, what they call to clean their head. And it's known, but as it happens in Israel, there is kind of self-censorship on many of the issues, and this particular issue that I am describing to you is not a secret. My son, after serving in the army 3 years, took his backpack and left for South America. And I have many students who are doing the same. And they explicitly are saying that serving in the occupied territory was for them a very traumatic experience, and they had to go for two years in order what they call to clean their heads.
Well, we've finished our conversation right on the hour. Thank you very, very much, Professor Bartel, for joining us. This was, I think, truly eye-opening, very interesting conversation. I would like to urge you to join us for future conference calls. We'll have more briefing calls coming soon. I'd also like to urge you all to check out our News Nosh. This is our daily update of news from Israel. You can go on our website and sign up if you haven't yet done that. Again, thank you very much for joining us, and thank you, Professor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This ends our call, and goodbye.
Bye-bye.